Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am one of your co-hosts, Paul David.
I am the other co-host of this podcast, and terrifyingly, the next line in our outline instructions is just banter in capital letters. So yeah, let's start bantering.
I think the banter is that we have three episodes we're recording back to back today for the first time ever, and that's it's a bit scary. Welcome to the podcast. Today's Zareen, CEO and co-founder of Cogs AI, the world's first mental well-being community built for neurodiversity. Welcome to the pod.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, both of you.
In terms of banter, Zareen and I both were attendees of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Zareen, you did your master's there, you said, in education?
Yeah, I mean, does that count as banter? Or is that just a fact?
Just small talk.
Oh, yeah, small talk. And then afterwards, you returned to the UK, and then you worked providing teaching support for neurodivergent teenagers before founding COGS. And you're also on TechRound's BAME 50 list for 2023. What is that?
I am. So, yeah, it was just an award for people of color who are doing interesting things in entrepreneurship. So, yeah, like less a fan of the BAME.
Tell us how you feel about the word BAME, because I think I might agree.
I mean, it is an acronym that is just trying to class a bunch of people into something that's easy to say in one syllable. So, yeah that's my thoughts on that.
Yeah. We were doing some outreach for King's College and trying to, like, get more diverse applicants. At first, we were, like, naming things BAME, and I was like, no one who is ironically BAME thinks of themselves as BAME. I don't wake up and, like, I'm going to be BAME today. You know, like, I think of myself as Black. I mean, like, you know, so it's, like, interesting choosing. Maybe shout out to TechGround. We'll have you on the pod. You can explain yourself, you know. Well, first things first, I mean, want to just, like, hear from your own words just about what you've built and just a little bit of your personal journey to where you are now.
Yeah, of course. So I'm the CEO and co-founder of Cogs AI. I have another amazing co-founder called Felix. And yeah, the reason that we both got into this is that I've worked a lot with young people who are neurodivergent. And it was sort of through that journey that I decided I wanted to actually build something in the space. And I also at the same time discovered that I was autistic as well. But discovered is a bit of a weird term, but it's more like something you always knew, which then gets kind of affirmed by a medical diagnosis. And I'm sure we can talk a lot about that at another point. And yeah, Felix had a personal connection as well to neurodiversity, just through a family member. And yeah, we decided to work together and try and, you know, change the system. So that's why we're here.
And how's it going so far? Like, what are some of the recent highlights that y'all have come across?
So I guess recent highlights is we got a big NHS contract, which was awesome. And I think when people talk about, okay, like, what is the health system doing around neurodiversity, you obviously see, like, a lot of the bad headlines because, you know, things are bad. There's so many, like, terrible waiting lists and people aren't getting the support that they need. I think there are some trusts that are really trying to do good things. So the one that we're working with, Kent Community Health Foundation Trust, I'm sure they wouldn't mind me giving them a shout out. But yeah, they're really trying to be neurodiversity affirming. And so that's actually one of the reasons why they were kind of attracted to what Cogs AI is doing, because that's what we're all about.
It is something you see a lot in the news at the moment and quite often for ways that things are messing up. But, like, could you maybe just give our listeners a quick overview of what is neurodiversity and why it is so important?
I think a good way of thinking about it, there's almost two aspects of it. There's neurodiversity in the personal sense, so differences in brain structure, neurochemistry between all sorts of different people. But if you're neurodivergent, you're just much more likely to be further away from the average. So that's sort of one way of thinking about it on a personal level. And that will manifest in certain, I guess, diagnoses, if you're thinking about it from medical models. So if you're autistic, if you have ADHD, Tourette's, dyslexia, dyspraxia, for example. But I think one of the big things around neurodiversity generally as a concept is, rather than trying to think about things from a sort of medicalized perspective, it is more about differences rather than deficits. And another way of thinking about it is also just neurodiversity as a social movement, right? So in terms of how can society itself become, rather than accepting, actually, like, celebrating differences, right? Because I think obviously diversity is so great in any arena. So when you're actually talking about people's brains, like, it's so good to be able to embrace different ways of thinking.
In terms of some of the maybe where we are now from where we've come and hopefully where we're trying to get to, like, it does feel like this is finally something that is getting kind of a bit more of coverage, a bit more understanding. Obviously still a long way to go. How have you seen the progression and what's the promised land of where we want to get to in your mind?
In terms of progression, I think a lot of it is awareness. And I know there's kind of a pushback against things on TikTok and people yeah, I'm putting this in air quotes, like self-diagnosing, because self-diagnosing and self-IDing is completely valid. And I think one of the things that people, I guess maybe who aren't part of the community, misunderstand is they think like, oh, people just want to be neurodivergent because it makes them special. And it's kind of like an identity piece. But I think what people don't understand is actually to get to that stage where you start to acknowledge like, oh, actually, is there something different about me? Because most people by default don't want to be different, right? You're sort of trained to internalize wanting to like fit into a certain norm. So actually accepting that actually there is something different about me and maybe I should explore that more. It takes people years to come to that realization. So it's not just, oh, I've seen a TikTok video and now suddenly I'm autistic. That's not really how it goes. It's a lot of self-reflection and probably a lot of like pain. I don't necessarily want to say trauma because again, don't want to like speak for different people's experiences, but there will have been difficult things in people's lives which led them to want to get a diagnosis.
I'm curious about the piece around diagnosis, right? Like, so you mentioned that you had a medical diagnosis at some point. You mentioned people self-identifying or self-diagnosing and that being valid. So, and obviously there's like a whole history of the medical profession mistreating people who identify as neurodivergent. I come from an education background where lots of kids, particularly children of color, low income, are overdiagnosed in some ways of things and over-medicated, at least in the States. So just curious, like, to dig into that question of diagnosis and like how the, you know, sea change and the change that we're seeing in sort of social norms around this is changing what diagnosis is, what it looks like and what's considered valid.
I think this links a lot to what I was saying before about neurodiversity as a social concept as well. Because if it's much more accepted and differences are much more accepted, do you actually need to go through a medical process to say, okay, I'm autistic or I'm ADHD and therefore there's certain support that I need? And that could be formal support. So it could be from schools, it could be from employers, or it could just be understanding about yourself. So you know, okay, this is how my brain works. Therefore, in these kinds of scenarios, this is how I need to act or take care of myself, or this is where my strengths lie as well. I think at the moment, there just isn't enough information out there for people. So going through the medical route is sort of the default. And I think the actual, the move towards more self-ID is good because then people can also choose to, okay, so in this country to get ADHD medication, you do need a medical diagnosis and that makes sense, right? You shouldn't be able to just like, get pills from the pharma. So in that case, you can totally see why going down the medical route makes sense. However, you know, for other people, if they don't feel that they need medical type support, why go through the health system, right? So I think it's kind of dependent on your level of need and how much you feel you need specifically medical type support.
Curious to like just to dig in more into neurodiversity and the way that it kind of affects people's daily lives. What are, and I know it's varying, right? But like, what are the general needs that you would say, you know, folks in the neurodivergent community have when it comes to being in school, the workplace? Like what would you want our listeners to sort of think about as they're, you know, boning up on their awareness and becoming more knowledgeable about the issue?
Yeah, so probably a disclaimer, you touched on it already, right? Because neurodiversity is such an umbrella term. And also just even within people who have the same, again, air quotes, diagnosis, there is such in-group variation as well. So it's really hard to generalize. But I'd say maybe themes rather than specific needs. And this is coming from, so at Cogs AI, we use something called like participatory research, where we just like, we go out, everything we do is embedded in speaking to the community. And so we've actually spoken and interacted with so many different people. So I guess some themes which have come out, it's mainly things which affect people's day-to-day lives, but tend to be under-researched from an academic perspective. And also, I guess maybe not the main part of whatever a medical diagnosis has expected. So the big thing actually is emotions. And so, like, I guess the medical term for that would be like emotional dysregulation, right? But essentially what it means is the way someone is processing emotional information, you know, not even just them, like it could literally be how their brain is responding to different signals, varying from the norm, which then translates into different differences around mental health, how you respond to mental health therapy as well. And so I think that's been a big element. And you could actually see like across different forms of neurodiversity, just like terrible outcomes that people have when it comes to mental health.
Yeah.
So yeah, the stats are out there. But yeah, so I think understanding how someone responds to emotions better is something that needs to be researched more so that people can like understand themselves. And also if we need mental health therapy, that can actually be made appropriate for, neurodivergent brains. And I'd say the other sort of big theme is probably around, I guess, the different systems in your body and how they interact. Because obviously the brain, the nervous system is so complex. And so it's interacting with essentially your whole body. And I think there's a couple of things. So if you're autistic, you're much more likely to have gastrointestinal issues, for example. Like that's not really well understood. And something like that really affects your like day-to-day well-being, right? Or if you have periods, also like the time that you are in the month can have a big effect on just how you're experiencing different challenges. And similarly, we were speaking to people who are approaching menopause and they say something similar. It's a big thing with, as in, there's no research on this as of yet that I know about, but what we've heard like more than once, so it feels like this just can't be a one-off, is women being late diagnosed and previously having been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. So it's very much been like, oh, this is something that, you know, it's not seen as something that is fundamental to how someone's like brain is working. It's just like, oh, the classic thing of women being kind of called wrong in so many senses.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note too that like a lot of, for example, you know, mental health issues or just struggling with like well-being can be caused by people's lack of understanding responses about like what, you know, neurodivergence is. And it's not like necessarily inherent, right, to being neurodivergent. It's actually just dealing with society, not being built for you and not responding to you in like a caring sort of open way. And that for anyone, you know, you see that in folks of color who have to deal with all the stresses of, you know, institutional racism, things like that. There's a lot of social determinants of that stuff and distinguishing that from like what's inherent to the nature of your body and how it's built versus, you know, societal influences. So I think that's important.
We talk a lot on this pod about how like one of the unfortunate trends of the last 20 years that hopefully we're now for entrepreneurs like yourself starting to see reverse is like most tech is designed by middle class white men. And then you realize like, oh shit, so society. And so like one of the things that really resonated in the research for this was like this idea of masking strategies, where the way that I kind of most understood a modicum of what it must be like to be neurodivergent and dealing with this is like, you know, you are essentially putting on a show constantly to fit in with a system that's not built for you, and that like just how much stress and pressure that must just have, like in, you know, answering an email, let alone a full 9-hour work day. Just it must be absolutely exhausting.
Yeah, a lot of it is just that additional cognitive load, right, of having to do that every time you walk out of your door or pick up the phone
In terms of some of the success stories that you've seen, you know, both from yourself, your app, the research that you've been doing, when you manage to make workplaces more inclusive for neurodiverse folk, you know, how do they benefit? How do companies benefit? You know, how does society as a whole just benefit?
So a good way of thinking about it, so there's a concept in architecture called universal design. I mean, I'll just explain it quickly. So if you're an architect, you're building a public space, and say you put a ramp in to support wheelchair users, but actually you're going to have parents who are pushing prams who are going to benefit from it. You're going to have like teenagers on skateboards, right? You've immediately made this space so much more accessible and inclusive to a whole range of people because you've designed for one group with a specific need. And that's the best way of thinking about how can we change our education system, how can we change our employment system, because if you're making it more inclusive for neurodivergent people, you're also going to be benefiting so many other people. So I guess I don't know, flexible working is probably a very easy one, right? So if you're neurodivergent, just having that freedom to be able to choose when you work, how you work, is obviously a massive benefit. But then we can all think of multiple different groups who would also benefit from that.
I come to it from like the son of a dyslexic father, and have like seen him. It took me going into, you know, education and like learning about human development and brain development to like understand, you know, why he would get frustrated pretty quickly, and not necessarily with me, but just with like tasks and like when things were difficult to sort of manage and understand. And appreciate the point in this University of Michigan study about folks who are dyslexic being outside the box thinkers, because I've always thought of my dad like that. You know, it's part of the reason I exist. He adopted me, so anyone's going to adopt a child is already an outside the box thinker. And just really learning to appreciate that about him, and kind of just be grateful for his neurodivergence, because, you know, I probably owe much of my existence to the fact that he was an outside the box thinker. So and then like hoping that others, we can have that sort of generosity of spirit about folks across the neurodivergent spectrum. So
actually, just following on from that, also sorry if this is jumping around all over the place, but when we were talking about challenges that come up consistently, so self-esteem is definitely a big one. And most of that is the point that you were making before about actually it is society telling you, oh, you're wrong, there's something wrong with you. And every single system that you come into contact with isn't made for you. So you're actually just getting it affirmed over and over again. Whereas actually if the systems change to be more flexible, then that's when neurodiverse people are going to shine, right? And just bringing out that strengths-based narrative is something, what we call it, neurodiversity affirming. is something that's really important to us at COGS with what we're building. So yeah, I know it's important. It definitely is important to talk about the challenges, but I think also highlighting the amazing things about being neurodivergent, because it's literally who you are, right? So if you can't kind of accept that, it's going to have a big impact on your well-being.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, let's get into it. Let's talk about COGS AI, like kind of what inspired you to build it, what you're building. Tell us about the product itself. And I guess it feels like we're tapping into this really exciting moment of, like, you know, obviously there's all the developments with AI, but we're also, it seems like, turning a corner on how we even think about neurodivergence and have this great opportunity to, like, open up our understanding of what intelligence really is, you know? So, like, yeah, tell us a bit about your product.
I think I touched on this a little bit in the intro, but to take us back, 2017. And so I was working in tech. I was working for a med tech company, but at the same time, I was volunteering at a couple of children's organizations and then ended up working part-time for one. And it was running after school clubs for young people. And this is in air quotes, with behavioral difficulties. And a lot of these young people were neurodivergent. Actually, they didn't have behavioral difficulties. It was them coming into conflict with systems that were inflexible and not built for them. And I think for me, I could just see it, because when you're working with young people, right, you're just like, you know them. To a certain extent, right? Like, you can tell that it's, you know, it's not them, it's the system that's the problem. But obviously it's so hard to make any change in that institution. And also, you know, I wasn't a teacher, I didn't actually have any background in neuroscience or neurodiversity. So I was like, okay, well, I need to go and get educated myself. Yeah, so that's when I went to the US, I went to Hugsy, and then did a master's in education. And my specialism was education neuroscience and developmental psychology. And through that, I kind of, I guess, understood, like, the hardware, which is the brain, and then, you know, behavior all trickles down from that. That's kind of like the software. That's how I like to think about it. And yeah, so after doing that, got back to the UK and did a program called Year Here, which is sort of this postgraduate program where what they're trying to do is really, like, embed things in actually, like applied experience. So everyone's given a work placement, and I was, that was how I was put into the school, working as a teaching assistant for neurodivergent young people. But then again, in the school environment, and just kind of seeing, oh, it's like not working the way it should. And so I suppose I was like, I can't really make change from within the system. So I should start my own thing. And that's how COGS AI was born. Wow. And I met my co-founder Felix on that program.
The Year Here program.
Yeah.
Let's dive more into the product. Like, what specifically are you building? How does it work? How will folks engage with COGS AI?
Yeah, of course. So it's a mobile app. And currently we're really focused on practical tools and strategies that you can just use in the moment. And currently it's very much a mental health tool, and focusing on things which are neurodivergent specific. So when I was talking about, like, regulating your emotions. So we're kind of distancing it from being, you know, oh, like, I feel bad, I feel good. It's not really about that. It's like you're in a certain emotional or sensory state as well. Where do you want to be if you're not comfortable right now? And so we use certain things which are, again, neurodiversity specific. So there's the concept of stimming. So it means sensory self-stimulation. And it's essentially just like giving input into your nervous system that can either be sort of like comforting or can help block out other things which are uncomfortable. So, like, for me, I actually like wear this necklace, which I know just like looks sick, but it's also like a, it's like a stim. So I use it to sort of like block out things sometimes, like if I'm feeling nervous or whatever. Gotcha. And so with the mobile app, we actually use audio and visuals, and we let people create their own audio visual stims. So I actually think a little bit about, do you remember Windows Media Player?
Yeah.
So it's that kind of concept. So, funny. And our whole thing is actually, again, not being medicalized, letting people be really creative. So almost, you know, you can create the situation or the stim that works best for you. And yeah, so that's like sort of one feature set. We also have, I guess, more conventional sort of reflection tools. But again, we've made them a bit more neurodiversity specific in terms of having like certain types of structures around them.
Curious, have you seen any sort of applications of it yet? Like any testing you've done that like sort of unlocked new opportunities or new, I don't know, new horizons for the folks who were able to use it? Like, yeah, in any way.
Yeah, so we got a really nice piece of feedback actually. So I'd say the way the app is designed is probably for people who don't have highly complex support needs. But actually we had someone who started using it who joined our beta program, and they're in assisted living. So they need sort of support, quite a lot of support. They were saying one of the features, which is about actually how can you communicate to somebody else how you're feeling, not only about not understanding how you feel, so you can't even tell people that, but also like what are the words that I have to say, almost like exactly to get the support that I need. And yeah, they just gave some really good feedback and was like, I use this consistently. It's been so helpful in terms of, you know, me just being able to get what I need. And that was a really, like, a nice feeling when you're like, yes, it's good to hear that we're making a difference.
That's really cool. We had Helena Larsen, who runs Teemo, their app out of Copenhagen. And she was on the pod a couple weeks ago and mentioned that, you know, that theirs is like a daily planning app, you know, daily planning made visual, I think is their tagline. And she mentioned two folks, one who was able to go on a plane trip for the first time, or what you know, just like all the steps and things like that, or really travel for the first time, I think, and just map out all the steps because they were, you know, were having a hard time planning it out and feeling comfortable with it. I'm another person who was able to put on makeup, struggle with that before, but because of the app and the way it helped them kind of map out all the steps, it's just so empowering to see. And like, I think it's interesting that we take these other tools that, like, neurotypical, whatever that means, people use, you know, and for granted, like calendars or planners or all the things that we've just classed as like, oh, this is a standard tool. And now we have all this other suite of tools that are coming out for neurodiverse people. And hopefully there's like a flattening maybe of like, you know, hey, these are tools that we all just use, and we're all, you know, different in some way. And I mean, I guess a question for you there is like, do you dream of a day where like everyone is sort of on the broad spectrum, or do you think it's useful to have like neurotypical goal and neurodivergent and not kind of flatten out the entire spectrum?
So I think it goes back to that universal design, inclusive design kind of concept, right? So actually, if you're designing for people with like a higher level of need, it's going to be good for everyone. So the COGS app, for example, you don't have to be neurodivergent to use it.
Yep.
We're not even specific to a type of diagnosis. Like, we stay away from that language. Like, listen, if you feel that you need support with emotions, with this, with that, come here, this is the place for you. I think the one area where it might differ, so actually something that we're building out is much more learning content, but what we're doing is sort of peer-led learning. So it's talking to different neurodivergent change makers, but also just like day-to-day people that we've come across, and we're just like, hey, like, talk to people about your life so that people feel, you know, less alone. But also sometimes it's useful to be like, hey, that person does that, maybe I can try it as well. And so I think there'll be some scenarios that maybe, but I mean, it's always the case, right? That some people will resonate with more than others. And I think that's the other thing with neurodiversity, where obviously there's like your brain and how that functions, but then there's everything else about you, right? There's your personality, there's like your lived experience, there's everything which has like intersectionally made you who you are. And so I think that adds sort of a layer of complexity when you're building for neurodivergent people, because it's not just one type of person.
Right. Interesting. Have to ask you, I recently started watching Dating on the Spectrum on Netflix.
I haven't watched it.
Oh, I was dying to ask you this question. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I mean, I can tell you a little bit maybe why I...
Please.
I haven't looked into it at all. I guess there's a little bit of like, you know, when are you just kind of extracting from the communities that you get views? So that was my main reason, but I might be judging because I haven't actually watched it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was my nervousness going into it, like this, oh, you know, like at the risk of like people laughing at the community, or like, you know, like you said, like extracting things and sort of looking at them as more of a curiosity and stuff like that. I felt after watching it, I personally felt that the way that they did it, I think was like very intentional, very careful. And I sort of just watched, skip to the second season, but I found it really interesting. And like, I'm just fascinated by this concept of using arts and entertainment as a way to build understanding and things like that. And I think they did, you know, a decent job, but super curious to hear your opinion as someone who works deeply in the community. So maybe we can talk about it next time, but yeah. just
and I'll definitely watch it now, because you've given it a good review.
I don't, it warmed my heart, like just the way that they, you know, like it just really helped me as someone who maybe doesn't identify as neurodivergent, but just like really understand all the issues that come up and the things that we just take for granted, like going to a date and like the prep that they do and the, you know, yeah, it was fascinating.
Interesting that you brought up dating. That's probably another like consistent theme that comes up as well. And, you know, not just for autistic people, but interacting with humans anyway is so complex. So then when you're adding different layers on top of it, and probably another thing, and like, it would be interesting to see if there's anyone doing this work, but especially around issues of like consent and how can you kind of like build sort of understanding between different people for that as well.
Yeah, they did a really good job of showing a diversity of experiences. Like one of the folks in the show went on a safari in Kenya, and then another one, you know, went to like a speed dating mixer, and then one of them, you know, holds down a job at a hotel, and they show him interacting with customers and just like being sort of the life of the party. It was just really... yeah, really well done in showing, I think, a range of experiences and how neurodiverse folks in those communities dealt with it. You know, some had coaches, some had parents or friends that would help them. Like, it was just really, yeah, I think really well done. So worth a watch, I'd say.
Yeah, sharing lived experience at scale in a way that's like genuinely sympathetic is one of the very few times like TV becomes kind of like, you know, really powerful and helpful. Yeah. It's interesting, my girlfriend's in TV and film, and they are increasingly like really aware of that responsibility in a way that's quite pleasant to see. Like, even when you're trying to create something mass media, like there's so much safeguarding and like, are you going to make this community better off or worse off before you get started? And if the answer is worse off, then we're not, you know, we're not making the show, or we're rewriting things. And so it's, there's a lot of good stuff in terms of where it's moving. You know, you always have trashy American producers that create total crap, but that it is what it is. But yeah, in the UK at least, it does feel like there's a bit more understanding of that responsibility than there ever has been before, which is quite cool. I'm not seeing that show, but I'll definitely check it out. In terms of the product and how it's going, like how many users have you got? Like, what's the adoption rate going? Like, what's that journey been like?
Yeah, of course. So we have sold 18,500 licenses to the NHS and to local authorities, and they sort of deploy them at their own rates. I think at the moment we have just over 2,000 monthly active users.
Wow.
But yeah, so we're just waiting for the NHS to be like, come on, we have got capacity for like 20,000, like put it through us. So that's pretty amazing.
Are you going to go down that NHS route as much as possible? Like a bit of both, but like B2C play? Like, yeah, how are we trying to get as many people enjoying Cogs AI as possible?
So at the moment, it's available, like I said, through NHS and local authorities, but also there is a consumer version, so people can pay for it themselves. Personally, I'm not actually like a fan of that, because I would rather it was coming through the health service so that the end user didn't have to pay, but we just have it there.
Yeah.
You know, because at the moment, like I said, we're only in Kent and Kent and Medway, so that sort of surrounding area. Okay. We're also in Hertfordshire. And as we start getting more and more trust through, obviously more people will have access to it. But until that happens, we don't want people to be prevented from using it. But yeah, so our main play is definitely public sector. So we kind of see ourselves as being, you know, the public sector provider for neurodivergent services, and very much taking a neurodiversity affirming lens to that. And actually what's interesting with the work that we're doing with Kent and Medway is that we're actually helping them change the system.
Yep.
So change the way that they're thinking about when people are coming through, trying to get diagnoses, how can we actually, I guess, kind of the concept of, you know, like trauma-informed systems design, kind of doing that, but much more through a neurodiversity affirming lens.
Requisite, I mean, we have to ask as like a marketing, you know, growth agency, but like, what does your roadmap look like for scaling to more trust? Like, do you feel like you have a clear plan to kind of grow the number of trusts you're working with?
Yeah, so I'd say we have a sort of two-pronged attack when it comes to public sector. So NHS trusts are very hard to convert, but once you get there, you get like a big contract and you're kind of embedded in the system.
Nice.
And those network effects really work for you, because once, you know, already people are like, oh, you work with Kent and Medway, interesting, let's start having a conversation. And so it's very much a relationships game, actually, working with the NHS, which is something that I didn't expect. You're kind of wanting to see, oh, look, there's this playbook and you just follow all the steps. But actually it's, you know, it's really a people kind of driven business. Essentially, me and Felix kind of divide and conquer. Mm. We just will go and speak to everyone and sort of build those relationships on a personal level. And then we'll sort of come together when it looks like it's a little bit more getting closer to like a business contract. And then local authorities are actually a little bit easier in the sense that they tend to, they either put things out for tender, and so they're looking for something very specific, and so we apply for that if we think that we fit the bill. Or we're also trying to work on much more of a sort of like going to them and being like, hey, this is what we're already doing with different people. We could also solve these problems for you as well. But local authority contracts tend to be a bit smaller, but easier to get. So actually you have like the big NHS things going, and like that's more of a long-term plan, whilst in the short term you're getting these small local authority contracts to help with cash flow.
Is the trust more likely to sign on with you if you've gotten a local authority like nearby on board, or is it, how's it
so
work?
So we actually got the trust because they sort of speak in autism conference, and they actually like came to us.
Oh, wow.
But I would say in general, because there's something called like integrated care boards where like NHS trusts will sit, but also local authority representatives as well. So more people who have heard of you, the kind of easier it is at the end of the day to get them to believe in you and want to use your product.
I imagine a lot of like digital health apps in general have cropped up, you know, since the pandemic and the lockdowns and things like that. Do you feel like the space is saturated? Are you competing with a lot of similar apps? Or
so with neurodiversity, there's a few things happening, I guess, much more in the B2C.
Okay.
And so when it comes to players that are working in the public sector, it's either incumbents who've been doing things for a long time, and I wouldn't, I mean, I don't want to speak badly.
Feel free to name
people.
Names if you want.
No. It's just more like I really believe in lots of people working in the space. The more people there are, the better it is.
Yeah.
So, for example, there's like a company called Brain and Hand, which do much more like the scheduling that you were talking about.
Yeah.
But kind of just with a lot more human-based support as well. But they're like a lot more expensive than what we provide. So they're obviously not that accessible at scale. Whereas for us, we're like, we're providing something which can scale really easily and can be used by a lot of people because it doesn't have that human in the loop.
So one of the other bits of the product that I'd love to talk to you about, and we read your recent Sifted article about kind of the risks of AI and, you know, how actually AI can be used responsibly. So just wanted to pick your brain on like how you've built a product that does use AI for good, and just generally any advice that you'd give to founders who are looking to do responsible use of AI rather than all the doom and gloom stuff that you hear in the media.
Cool. And just to be a little bit specific, because I'm sometimes pedantic about stuff like this. So at the moment, Cogs AI is in our name, and we know that this problem has to be solved using AI and machine learning just because of the diversity that we were talking about, right? But at the moment, there's no AI in the product. We're essentially a data collection tool. So we're trying to understand our users as much as possible through the use of data. And then based on that, we'll start applying data science. So that's in our 6-month roadmap. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to most people, that essentially does mean AI, but I just wanted to be specific.
Yeah. And you say last 6-month roadmap, like the previous 6 months or moving
forward?
Sorry,
the next 6 months.
Next 6 months, got it. Okay,
gotcha. I mean, even that seems like a really responsible and ethical way to build an AI model versus buying a bunch of publicly traded data and then, you know, making a shitload of assumptions and buggering things up.
And I just say with neurodiversity, we wouldn't, even if we wanted to do that, we wouldn't be able to, right? You just come out with a product that doesn't work for people.
Yeah.
But from, I guess, how do you design a responsible AI product? It's not that sexy or interesting. Essentially, you just have to like be really hot on your risk analysis. So I said before how I used to work for medtech companies. So we were class one medically regulated device. And essentially, I just took a lot of that thinking where you actually think through the risks of what you're building right from the beginning, right from the ideation stage, all the way through into software engineering and right at the end to quality assurance. And I think if you build out a culture of like compliance, again, it's just like not sexy words, but if you build that out throughout your team, everyone starts thinking about it, everyone takes ownership and responsibility for it. So you actually manage to surface a lot more potential risk than if it was just one person who was doing that job.
Yeah, I mean, it's inspiring, and hopefully you're getting at least some credit, some funding from funders and the trust for taking that amount of care and intentionality into it, because we had some guests on the show previously. I'm just talking about this kind of like cowboy churn and burn mentality in a lot of VC spaces, at least. And, you know, people building things irresponsibly, and like the care that's needed in the medical tech, health tech, neurodiversity tech, I'd say, space to build something that is really like powerful for that community, but thoughtful and not, you know, going to damage people, hurt people, you know. And hopefully we're seeing a new era of products that like take that kind of care and are you know, very careful with each step they take there. So
you couldn't see the face that I made just there. Like, I hope you're getting credit for it. I was like, I honestly don't think most people care. I hate to say it. Yeah, so I think it really is on like innovators to, I think in the social good space, people are, you know, they're in it because they don't want to have unintended consequences, which like hurt society. So I think it's much more of a natural thing to think that through. Maybe I wouldn't assume that anyone's going to get credit for it, though.
I do think there is something to be said for like, at some point, you maybe not solve a problem, but make a problem better through the use of AI to show like how much, because like that problem that you're essentially facing of how do you do true personalization at scale for the specific needs of a user? Like obviously it's specifically for a neurodivergent case, but it's applicable across the board in so many helpful ways to society. Everyone always thinks of like all the scary stuff of AI, but like eventually there's going to be a product that comes out and shows like, but here's the positive side. Here's the potential of human genius when it's conducted at like not creating 100,000 Midjourney like AI images of cute kittens.
We're rooting for you.
Any sort of final thoughts, like about anything you want to share with our audience about like exciting updates, you know, maybe a bit more about the roadmap that y'all are taking through the rest of the year about Cogs AI, just any special things you want to preview, you know, we love announcements.
Can I do some shout outs to other people in the space? So there's an organization called Uncommon. So their website is bemoreuncommon.com. And so they work mainly with younger people. So I think it's secondary school age, but probably fact check that. And I think what they do is a little bit different from us. So I said, like, we're not human in the loop because for us, it's all about like self-serve, letting people experience things at their own pace. But also there is definitely place in the system for much more care that's embedded with other people. And so they do really great peer support and also like facilitated by neurodivergent facilitators who really understand what people are going through. Mm-hmm. And just creating those online spaces that young people can come to is so important. So they're doing amazing work. And then another organization called Speak, so S-P-E-E-K, and their website is joinspeak.com, I think. And so they're not actually neurodiversity specific, but what they do is, again, working with young people who essentially are trying to recover from self-harm behavior. And yeah, definitely a lot of things that we've heard anecdotally, and I think there's also some... Again, so many statistics about this that I won't go into it about, yeah, just like the incidence of self-harm amongst neurodivergent young people. And so again, having organizations that are tackling something that is so difficult, I've just got so much respect for them. So yeah, that's so great. Those are my big shout outs, basically.
Uncommon and Speak.
Yes.
Tell us a bit more about where our audience can find out more about you, more about Cogs AI, and just what all the good stuff y'all have going on.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, our website, www.cogs-ai.com. So I hate social media. So I am not really big on it.
Do you include LinkedIn in that?
I mean, LinkedIn, you kind of have, I mean, obviously you hate it. Who likes LinkedIn?
Yeah.
But yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. Yeah. So just like add me, drop me a little message, because I love speaking to people who are doing things in the space or who are just interested and want to have a chat. So yeah.
Cogs-ai.com.
Thank you for jumping on the pod. Really enjoyed the conversation. We've covered the topic of neurodiversity and not as it relates to AI specifically. And I love the intentionality and the care that you're taking and your roadmap to including AI in your product. And yeah, just when I first met you and heard about Cogs AI and the good work you're doing, I was like, got to get you on the pod. So thank you for taking the time, coming down in studio. And we really, really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for all of the banter.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. It's been another episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We've had our amazing guest, Zarine Ali, the co-founder of Cogs AI. Yeah, it's been a great conversation. Check us out at Literal Humans, Tech Can't Save Us, on all the socials and all the apps that Zarine loves so much, social media. And yeah, please subscribe, listen to our episode and share it with a friend. Give us a 5-star rating if you can, and we'd be really grateful for that. We can get more great guests like Zarine on the show. So thanks, y'all.